You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Have you ever considered that maximizing profits could be a really selfish way of investing your money? And do you know where to bank to make the most difference in the world? Stay with us as we address these questions and more with Scott Klinger. Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
And I greet you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. And I think maybe your air is getting a little clearer, finally, in the midst of all the California fires. So I hope that's true.
Yes, we started seeing stars two nights ago, and last night I could see lots of stars.
Wonderful.
So that was really welcome. Well, we continue in this episode to focus on how to live amid the multiple crises of the 2020s. We accept the guidance of over 200 scientists globally who tell us plainly that we must keep global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. And that to do so, massive changes in our economic and social systems must happen. Our guest, Scott Klinger, shares some of what he has learned about these systems and how to change them.
Well, I met Scott, Jerry, some years ago now in a gathering of people that at the time were meeting as the Sabbath Economics Collaborative. We were really sharing stories together from working in an alternative economy, an economy that's really earth-based and creation-based. And Scott was in a number of those meetings, and we got to be friends in that way. And we've carried on that friendship in the years since. I want to just share that from an email that he sent me as we prepared for this podcast episode. Scott said, "My current thinking is about how the world could be different if we all invested in creating the world we want to live in, rather than investing to maximize our financial returns. What would maximizing our justice returns look like?" I think it's really a provocative question. Well, we can contrast what we do with indigenous peoples' values around money. For indigenous peoples, wealth is held collectively. There are usage rights to the earth, but not ownership rights, as white society thinks of it. And by the way, you know, this is much closer to the biblical narrative where it says that the earth is the Lord's, and the Jubilee economic narrative, which is very clear that we can own things that we produce on the earth, but we can't, the land itself is sacred and can't be reduced to a commodity. Well, continuing now with Scott's email, when you go to an indigenous community, the leader may well be one of the materially worse off people. That's because the principal responsibility of leadership is to look after the well-being of the people. Well, in the U.S. and in the capital economy, we've turned that model upside down. The role of a leader is to send money up the financial food chain, not down. And so the CEOs are the wealthiest in a company, not as it happens in traditional indigenous societies. Continuing finally with Scott's last paragraph, we can talk about legal barriers to bringing this sort of world about and some concrete ways that listeners can invest their own assets and ask questions of the pots of money they may influence with their employers, with their churches, and with community foundations. Well, these are the things that we'll be talking about. And also, I encourage you to watch for articles by Scott on the Common Dreams news outlet. You'll see them there from time to time. So now we can go to our previously recorded conversation. I'm talking now with Scott Klinger, all the way in Maine, and I'm in San Diego, and I can't help but smile. I'm smiling about both the fact that we can do this, and then I'm smiling because it's just so much fun for me whenever I get to talk with Scott. So just let's tell people a little bit
more than we did in the lead up to this conversation, Scott, about who you are. And I'm thinking especially about two things. One is, over the years, you've been involved in a number of projects. And all of these sounded very interesting to me, by the way. And maybe you could say a little word about that. And then also, all along, you've been strongly motivated by your spiritual path. So let's come right out from the beginning with both of those, and you can take them in which order, whichever order you want.
Sure. Well, thanks so much, Lee. This has been a long time in coming, and I'm really glad to have some time with you and your audience. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and my childhood was pretty normal. My family lived in the suburbs. It was a lily white suburbs, and in 1968, a black family moved in, a minister, and within about 6 months, his house burned to the ground. The fire department didn't even seem like they came. Not being aware of any racial justice issues, even though it was the 60s, I was still a little kid, 8 years old. Never really thought much about it until I got to be older and realized that there was arson. You know, they were violently driven out of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And no black families moved in again until the rural parts of the western part of our city were cleared of all the vineyards and luxury housing was built and athletes and CEO types started moving in. And then so all of a sudden the city started celebrating its black citizens because they were famous pro athletes and wealthy. I went to school in North Carolina at Duke, and Ohio is a kind of conservative place. So my freshman year, I got roped into being a student leader for Jesse Helms and campaigning for Senator Helms in his first campaign. I don't think I really bought the whole ideology, but it was a fun thing to do, and kind of an exciting time in a new campus and in a different part of the country. That spring, I took a course in liberation theology, and that's really where my faith development starts to shift. And one day, the teacher was talking about some theologian whose name I don't remember, and said something, and I spouted off that, you know, poor people used food stamps to buy junk food. And he stopped the class and he said, gave the class an assignment to write some paper on this obscure theologian. But he told me I was supposed to go down to the Kroger and stand behind the lines for a couple hours and write down what was in people's carts and what form of payment they used, and to come back and tell the class the next time we met. And I came back and I saw that poor people, everybody's carts had more or less the same thing in it. Poor people bought more larger sizes, value sizes. Everybody had some junk foods, you know, chips and sodas and stuff, but poor people didn't have any more than anybody else. And it began to make me see that a really important spiritual truth for me was to trust what I had seen. And the professor kept saying that, what have you seen? What have you seen? What have you seen? And I kept telling him what I've been told. So I think that's my first grounding and where I'd like to begin. And then I'll tell the rest of the story rather quickly, but after I graduated, I did a year of volunteer work in Southwest Alaska in Jesuit Volunteer Corps in a group home with Yupik Eskimo boys. I've been blessed to have many encounters with Native Americans and Native Alaskans and indigenous people around the world in my life. And we'll talk about some of that as we go on. While I was there, my last grandparent died, and I was told, after I went through all the mourning and funerals and everything, 6 months later, I was told that I was going to receive $8,000 from their estate, my grandparents' estate. And I began to really think about that in this remote little village in Southwest Alaska. And it seemed to me it wasn't just money to buy a car or go to grad school or something like that, but it really represented something of their lives, their what was left over after they paid for the things they needed to live. And there was a very early form of the internet that the University of Alaska had assembled just in state. And I started looking at that and messing around with it and discovered there was this very infant movement called social investing. And I had about 6 months before I had applied to seminary and never went, but applied to seminary and had 6 months to fill. So I signed up for an internship at one of these social investing places in Boston, and it turned first into a part-time job and then within about 6 months into a paid job, and I deferred going to seminary and stayed in social investing. I was one of the first people doing social investing starting in 1985 and did portfolio management and securities research and a lot of social activism and loved it, but didn't feel like there was enough bang for the buck. So I jumped to the nonprofit side, took about a 70% pay cut. I always joke my biggest earning year was when I was 28. It's bounced around much lower than that ever since. I'm 60 now, so it's a long time to bounce. But I've had a bunch of fascinating experiences. I'll just mention two, but one of them was I directed a group called Responsible Wealth, which organizes millionaires and billionaires to work for economic justice. So I had the real joy and blessing to spend a week a year for 4 years in a row with Bill Gates' dad, Bill Gates Sr., who just passed away. And he's a really remarkable man, very down to earth and humble, and had lots of wonderful conversations with him. The other experience was I took a job with a small nonprofit in Central Virginia that works with indigenous people. And shortly after I arrived, they received a large contract from Shell Oil to help them improve their indigenous people's policy, which were not in great shape around the country, around the world. And so I became actually in kind of an embedded, seconded worker to Shell. I was an advisor to one of the senior executives in Shell Canada, and worked with her and her team to really understand cultural values. Shell had just put out a report called Three Hard Truths, which were about things like climate change and new technologies and peak oil, things like that. And I responded and wrote four soft truths, which were all cultural things. The first one was never arrest a granny when elders show up on picket lines. You know, the worst thing you can do is to arrest the elders and not understand that they're revered people within indigenous cultures. Another one was always leave a place better than you found it, which wasn't a value within any sort of extractive industry sector. And so things like that. And I was really heartened that so much of what I had to say was taken seriously. And it also taught me that about thinking about adversaries or people that don't seem like they're pulling on the oar in the same direction as we are. But there's good people everywhere. And I found an immense number of good people within Shell. And even there in that setting, when people didn't see things the way I did, we had respectful dialogue and we learned things from each other. And so I've always held that experience as a particularly fond memory. And I've kept up a few of those friendships, even though it was 15 years ago or more at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else that you want to say about your spiritual path, Scott?
Well, I've always been really interested since that early day in Alaska when I thought about the meaning of money. I've always been really interested in the gospel teachings around money. And I don't think Christian people pay enough attention to this. I think many are waking up to the spiritual role of their consumer purchases, particularly the foods they consume. There's a lot more interest in people are willing to pay extra for supporting community agriculture, which is fantastic. But I'm really interested in people thinking about the investments they make. Mm-hmm. When they put money in a checking account, what's that bank doing with their money? And yeah, when they put money in a 401k, what kind of world are those investments making? Or even at their churches. I know early, before I was a volunteer in Alaska, I did a year with Lutheran Volunteer Corps in Baltimore at a kind of weak urban parish. All the people had moved to the suburbs, and it was one of these things where people drove back in on Sunday because that's where mm-hmm. their grandparents and their parents grew up. And, you know, it was struggling for sure financially. But I happened to look one day, and they had like $500,000 in a savings account to manage a small cemetery that was established a century earlier. Mm. And I inquired about it, and they said, yeah, we pay a neighbor boy $10 a week to cut the grass in the summer. It costs about $300 a year. We make like $4,000 on it. It just keeps growing and growing. And I said, well, why don't you like think about how to invest it in a way that would really benefit the city of Baltimore or benefit you know, other like local people trying to start businesses. Mm-hmm. And I had never thought of that. And so I think there's probably those pots of money all over the place. And even though we think, you know, I think of it as a poor church, but in reality it wasn't,
yes,
you know, as poor as definitely wasn't as poor as I thought about it. And many can make the case it wasn't poor at all. So, you know, I think one of the things I'd like to talk about in the time we have is sort of how we go about integrating our faith into our investments and our money, our money lives, and really thinking, you know, I think about so much of our, the messages we receive are about individualism, and we have to take care of ourselves, provide for ourselves in our retirement. And it really comes out of a sense of scarcity and out of fear, like no one else will take care of us. I hear lots of younger people say, oh, Social Security is not going to be around. And it leads people to buy into this, I have to maximize my returns, my financial returns. And every time I hear someone say that, I think, well, what would the world be like if we maximized justice returns or gospel returns? And how would the world be different? And, you know, I think about like a trade-off between, you know, earning 20% a year on my retirement savings, like a really rich return financially. And then I get to retirement and the world is full of environmental devastation, inequality, racism, all the things that are not the world I want to live in. Versus if I could accept a much smaller return, you know, 2 or 3 or 4%, and have a world that has more of the justice that I would like to retire with and hand on to my child and grandchild.
Yes. Well, you've just segued wonderfully into some of the rest of our conversation here as you've introduced us to your life story. And you know, you're exemplifying in that story, but then also now as we talk about some of the issues that are close to your heart, what we're wanting to do in these podcasts, which we have just once a month, is these episodes of the podcast, where we want to be talking about how do we live in the 2020s? What kind of world do we need to create with our actions, given the fact that we have 10 years now, about 9 years before we hit that 2030 mark, which the international panel of climate change has told us is the year by which we really need to make the decisions that turn back the greenhouse gases and the rising temperatures around the globe. And of course, as we talk, we're in the context of extreme wildfires in the West Coast and extreme water trauma in the Gulf states, and coast to coast, there's the enormous enormity of this pandemic, which again is climate related in its origins. So all of this is the context, and we're wanting to talk about, well, how do we, what kind of things do we do to create the world we want? And so here we're talking about the investing, a kind of gospel investing or justice investing, where you say, well, what would maximizing our justice look like instead of maximizing our profits? So this I think really resonates, and let's just flesh that out in every way we can going forward. How do we maximize justice, meaning by justice the kind of world that feels fair and right for us to retire into, or for the next generations to live in? So I know that you may want to say more about maximizing justice on our financial returns. How do you do that? You've done it through socially responsible investing, but I think socially responsible investing, in at least as it was earlier conceived, has gotten a little bit weak for the radical needs we need today. And by radical, I mean just really getting to the basic stuff, because socially responsible investing in many cases has become a kind of greenwashing, I think. So can you address that just a little bit, Scott?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I have a 35-year perspective on social investing, which then became environmental social governance, ESG investing, and now is impact investing. And while there are some good things done, I think what you just said about it being a marketing scheme is frighteningly true. And so that's one of the reasons I moved even 20 years ago. And I would say it's more of a problem now than it even was then. I think the question really to me is who controls the money and whose interests are being served in investing it. And, you know, the earliest conception of social investing, which I participated in wholeheartedly, was still rooted in Wall Street. And it was kind of a kinder, gentler Wall Street, looking for the companies that had policies that were better to workers or more caring of the environment or less threatening to human rights. Mm-hmm. It was kind of always a lesser of two evils sort of choice. And in many ways, that was good. I think the good part of it was it made people aware and it led people to see they could ask a question. And one of the things I was always happiest about is when I lived in Boston at the time, and so got invited almost every day to meet with a different management, company management that was in town, either updating investors or trying to sell stock. And, you know, it was a pretty wide open situation. We had access to the top leaders. You could ask them questions. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first started, you know, I kind of had to hang around afterwards and ask a question about their environmental performance or whether they had any women in management or, you know, those kinds of questions, or certainly wouldn't ask a public question about the CEO pay with the CEO in the room. And as time went on, you know, within 5 or 10 years, those became questions that more mainstream investors were regularly asking because they recognized the answers to them had something to do with the financial performance of the company, even if they didn't come at it from a moral or justice point of view. And so there were good things, there are and were good things that have come out of that. But as you said, you know, time is short. I look back over 35 years and I say, is the world really better than when I started in 1985? And while in some cases, you know, certain cases, the answer is yes, in terms of gay rights, in terms of sensitivity to sexual harassment, cultural diversity, those things have moved in a positive direction in many cases. But the bigger social issues are definitely far worse. And I would say that corporations have more control and more power than they did in 1985. So the real question to me is sort of who holds the cards and who holds the power and how they make decisions. And one of the places it's clearest, and the reason I think people should interrogate where they have their checking and savings accounts in their local community, is in community development. And, you know, we all want community development. It's a positive word with a positive connotation, but you know, most of us that live in cities can tell us a similar story about the investments of the banking community and the developer community and the city through subsidies all go to the same small pieces of land that where the rich live or the financial institutions are or are in a pretty spot by the water, and that means that other parts of the community are disinvested. I lived in Baltimore for 15 years before moving to Maine. In the Inner Harbor, everyone knows the Inner Harbor and loves the Inner Harbor and likes to come and visit and play and has good feelings about Baltimore because of the Inner Harbor. But a few miles from the Inner Harbor is West Baltimore and East Baltimore. And there's 10,000 vacant houses in Baltimore. None of them are at the Inner Harbor because those are all multi-million dollar condos. But in the same city, and people talk openly. It's not a, if you say two Baltimores and you live in Baltimore, people know exactly what you mean. It's the rich and famous Baltimore and then the poor and usually people of color part of Baltimore, where the city doesn't cut the grass and knows what you mean when you say two Baltimores. There's the one where the rich and famous and powerful live and the city invests and banks invest, and then the other part, which is primarily black and brown people, low-income people, where there's disinvestment and empty houses and lots of crime. I'll tell a funny little story. That's not so funny, but a story. There was a movie called The Rat Film that's really good that I recommend. And it was shot by a Baltimore filmmaker about the rat problem in Baltimore. Every year the city does a rat census. They go out and count all the rats and figure out what neighborhoods they're in. Many of your podcast listeners may not know, but Baltimore was actually the first city in the country to legalize or mandate housing segregation back in 1911. And it actually went to the case went to the Supreme Court. It was struck down. The city people, the white supremacist leadership in the city, came back and figured out they could do require covenants on deeds to say, I will not sell my house to a person of color or to a Jew. That was not, I think it was somewhat struck down, but it was allowed to persist. So the original map, literally, and it wasn't just totally an anti-black thing. If you were a white family that lived in a predominantly black neighborhood, you had to move. And if you were a black family that lived in a white neighborhood, you had to move. So it was just to get purity and keep the races apart. So that map by block by block, is the exact same map where all the rats live today, where the predominant amount of gun violence is today, where the infant mortality is today, where the dropout rate is high today, with very little exception. It was a brilliant piece of filmmaking because at the end, they just overlay one map over the other. And maybe there's a one little black square here and there that doesn't fit the original 1911 map. But you really see firsthand the impact of decisions made, not just in 1911 when the law was passed, but by every generation since, including the bankers today that don't invest in the areas inside that map. It's sometimes called the Baltimore butterfly because it has two big wings and a skinny little center city part where all the investment goes in the downtown business district, where all the finance companies and the corporate headquarters are. So to me, it's like a really powerful model.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation. During this break, I'd like to make a few announcements. Jubilee One Earth Economics has begun to post videos for free on YouTube. So check for a link in the show notes to see these new videos. Number two, you can be a promoter of Jubilee Living. Watch for information about a new Jubilee school and even a certification course. Number three, in our previous podcast episode, we interviewed Lane Van Ham on the power of immigration advocacy. You can get his new book, Composite Nation, A History of Immigration Advocacy in the United States, directly from One Earth Publishing, a service of Jubilee One Earth Economics. And number four, during Advent, the four-week period before Christmas, read and use Lee's new book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, a birth story able to reverse the earth's perils. Read and hear more about it at the links in this episode's show notes and at theoneearthproject.com/books. That's theoneearthproject.com/books. Order a copy directly from Jubilee or from various suppliers on the internet. Now we return to our conversation with Scott Klinger.
I've approached my own tendencies to consumerism, and I'm not a wild consumerist, but I love my books and order a lot of books, spend a lot of money on books. And I'm trying to thinking about the other things I spend money on and think about learning more about where things come from and what their impact is. And it slows me down, especially when we live in a world with long supply chains that are often invisible. And I think one of the, you know, I don't want to say positive, but one of the instructive things about COVID is it's made us much more aware of supply chains because they've all been interrupted. And we get to hear the stories of the meat plants where everyone's sick and the farm fields in your part of the woods in California where workers are not protected in the fields. And therefore there are shortages of lettuces and other things that come from California. And, you know, obviously all the slowdowns in the mail and this shipping traffic, you know, there's a weird, we moved into a new house and we need a new refrigerator and we can't find a refrigerator because the supply chains to Asia are so disentangled and broken at this point.
Well, you're giving such a picture of how systemic these things are to, and your life is really time and again, you've found, you have a sensitivity, first of all, to this and an educated sensitivity. And then also you just continue to find these revelations of how the systems are arranged. As a sign said in these many protests, the system isn't broken, it's designed this way.
Exactly.
So you've said that so well. Well, that's and you've shown so well that how investment in one area inevitably means divestment in another. I don't know if it has to be that way, but somewhat, because there is at any given moment a certain amount of money to work with. But you've had a lot of experience with the indigenous worldview. And so a lot of, I think, what you understand about maximizing justice, moving in the direction to the world we need to in the 2020s, is informed by your experiences with Indigenous people. So, you know, let's turn you loose on that for a little bit.
So I'd say a couple of things come to mind on this topic. One is, I've done most of my work with Indigenous communities in North America, but had a little bit of experience in other countries and cultures outside. And one of the things that seems true for people that, Indigenous people that continue with pretty traditional values, is when you meet the leaders of communities or tribes, tribal bands, they are not generally very well off materially, financially. And that's because in many Indigenous cultures, leadership means service and taking care of the people that you're charged to lead. And so I remember going in some reservations in the U.S. and thinking the person who was the tribal chief, you know, before I realized necessarily they were a tribal chief, that they were pretty poor. And then I realized it's because whatever money came in went out to help others who had greater needs than they did. And so that's a very different value than the one we celebrate in white dominant culture, where successful CEOs are, you know, revered and have all this power because they're rich. And then the second thing I would say is that the best examples of tribal communities I know have held their money collectively. I'll tell an interesting story. The cosmetic company Aveda was looking for partnerships with Indigenous communities in the Global South. And they had a guy who went out and traveled and met with different tribal people. There was a young boy, in the Yamamani community in Brazil, I think it is, who got sick as a kid and couldn't stay in his community because they didn't have the medicines to be able to take care of him there. So he had to go to the West Coast into California to get treatment, and he ended up going to college there. And so he became bicultural and understanding how American culture worked and became fluent in English and, you know, very successful in American university system. And then went back, got a call back from his tribe that the their leader was sick and dying, and they wanted him to come home and be the leader. And I think he was in his late 20s or something. And so he did. He left his California life and went back to the jungles in Brazil, where they were contending all the time with loggers and poachers and a lot of things that were really threatening their culture, their lifestyle, their economy. And I think either California or somebody knew of him. And so Aveda ran across him and they got to talking, like, what do you have that we could use? And they came upon this red berry that Aveda wanted for cosmetics as a colorant. And so they entered a contract for this red berry, but the guy, the Yamamani chief, Tosca, I think his name was, said, and we need to produce this in a way that enriches our culture. So he took some time and thought of the way he could adapt a tribal dance into the harvest and production of these berries. And the contract that they entered with Aveda was very simple. They agreed on a place where they would make the handoff of berries, and I think a price that would be paid. And Aveda left all the rest to the cultural practices of the Yamamani, like how they would harvest it, how many berries they'd bring. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to bring too many, you know, if it would disturb the trees. And so then this tribe in the jungles of Brazil began to get cash. And what they did was two things. One, they invested in a satellite phone. So when they had a problem, they could call instead of having to, I forgot to say, when they gathered the berries, it was like 2 days to get it out. They had to load it in canoes and go, you know, here and there and get to this place where Aveda would meet them, presumably with a truck or some other kind of modern Western vehicle to move the berries to the next point. Uh-huh. So it was a real, took a lot of time for them to communicate with the outside world. So they built a phone for when there's emergencies. And they built a solar-powered generator so they could have refrigeration. So the next little boy, like Tosca, who needed medicine that required refrigeration, could stay in his village and be treated. The money was all held collectively. People weren't paid for their time doing the dance and harvesting the berries. It was all for the benefit of the whole. And I think that's a really rich value. And one of the things I think that we as dominant culture Christian people can practice in thinking about how do we keep our money in community controlled investments, democratically controlled investments, not Wall Street investments. I really encourage people to figure out how they can detach themselves from Wall Street. It's not because there's not good people that work on Wall Street. It's because what you said earlier, Lee, that the system is structured not to serve people. It's structured to reproduce capital, not to reproduce justice. And so thinking about community development loan funds and community development credit unions and community banks, as opposed to the big global banks or the Wall Street mutual funds that invest in stocks and bonds put forth by Wall Street, and community businesses. I mean, there's been interesting work done in different parts of the country. Colorado's way out front, where it used to be that it would cost a company's a large amount of money to do a stock offering, to a public stock offering where anybody could buy their stock. And there's lots of accountant fees and lawyer fees, and it was prohibitively expensive. So typically most small businesses get funded by passing the hat around their family and friends and raising a few bucks and hopefully getting enough to get started, and then they can get some bank financing to keep going. But it's a very burdensome way to start. Colorado said, okay, well, you know, there's risks in doing this, that, you know, small businesses can have problems. So they said anybody can invest up to $2,000 in a, so they kind of capped the risk by putting a limit on the amount that can be invested. And so a lot of small businesses are getting going out of that because, if they can find 50 people that have put $2,000 and they have $100,000 all of a sudden, and they can do something with that. Yeah. So we need to change laws, I guess, as part of it, that make those kinds of things legal and accessible.
The laws have been such that unless you had, $10,000, $50,000, you couldn't invest in those kinds of local things because the risk was too high. But now those laws are starting to change, and Colorado must be a very good example of that.
Yeah. It's called accredited investors, and accredited is a gentle word for rich people. So they assume that rich people can assume more risk, and, and in fact, like a lot of the things that are, the Amazons and the Ubers and the Lyfts and things I wouldn't personally want to invest in, but those kinds of shoot the moon investments were never available to normal people. Mm-hmm. You had to be rich to get in on the ground floor. And so wealth begets wealth and that sort of thing. But that's not how we're going to build strong communities. We need to change the laws so we can all put our money in those kinds of investments, even like retirement assets. I have almost all of my retirement savings in the Self-Help Federal Credit Union in California. And Self-Help Credit Union, it's the kind of parent. It's not a parent because they're separate institutions, but the older of the two that spawned the one in California, in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And they're federally insured, so I don't have any risk. I get, people say, oh, you get a lower rate of return. Well, it was funny. When my daughter, who's now 31, was born, I started when I was working in the money management business then, so I got a bonus every year, and I put my bonus check away for her future, for her college. And I divided it evenly between a socially responsible stock and bond fund and a community development investment mm-hmm. that paid a fairly low fixed interest rate. And over the years, between the time she was a baby and 18, I did that every year. Like in January, I'd get my bonus check and I'd split it even exactly in half. And by the time she turned 18, they were worth almost exactly the same amount of money. Now, the one that was in the stock market had gone way up and way down. And if you looked at the graph, it was like a roller coaster, but it was like the tortoise and the hare. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened she went to school or started college during the downturn of 2008. So the stock market had just given back a lot of gains. Mm-hmm. And they were literally within $100 of each other after 18 years.
Yeah. I was wanting to say that there's lots to smile around that. And to say, well, it there's a good return in investing locally. At the same time, I think what you have said before is we don't do this because we think we're going to be able to match any other kind of level of income. We do it because this is justice and we're wanting to maximize justice. And if it so happens that it also does just as good in return, so be it. But you want to comment on that?
Well, another fun piece of that story was, and I would encourage people who are parents. It was my daughter's college savings, and I let her know I was doing this when she got to be older and understood what savings was. And it's funny. I'll tell a story before that story. So she was very little, and she had a savings account at a local community bank. And her mom and I would take her to the bank. She'd save up her allowance, and she'd get $15, and we show her to fill out her deposit slip and take it to the window. And we were driving around in the car one day, and she wasn't a real emotional kid, but she was always very attuned. We had the radio on, and public radio. And all of a sudden I looked over and she was crying, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I tried to think, well, what was this? Oh, there was just a story about a bank robbery on the radio. Oh, and it was her bank, the bank that we take her to was robbed. And I'm like, Kaylin, are you crying because of the bank robbery? And she shook her head, yes. And then she sniffled and she said, they took all my money that I saved. And I'm like, no, that's not how it works. You think your money's sitting on the shelf next to Johnny and Judy's? And she goes, yeah. I'm like, no, they take your money and they lend it to people. And then people pay money back to borrow that money. And that's how you get that little bit of money every quarter that they throw in your account extra. And then she got really indignant. She said, that's wrong. People should be able to use my money if they need it, just so they give it back when I need it. And I thought, out of the mouth of babes, just a sense of inbred justice. It didn't come from her mom and me.
Yeah.
It was just her sense of sharing and fairness of being a little kid. So when she got to be older as a teenager, I had told her, I'd have this money every year. I'd divide it in half and put it in these two different things. And one of the places where I had been investing the community piece was in Boston. And every year they ran a little bus tour around the neighborhoods to show what they had done with the investors. And we went to see what her money was doing in the neighborhood. And one of the stories I still remember to this day was they showed us this house that had been a crack house. And the loan fund had bought out the crack house and thrown a bunch of money into it and fixed it up and sold it off. And that crack house, one single house in a street of probably 30 houses, had destroyed the whole neighborhood. People were moving out. They were not painting their houses or putting any money into it because they thought the neighborhood was going down. But when the community loan fund came in and bought just one house and turned it around, everybody else started investing in their houses and the community came back and flourished off that one, maybe $50,000 investment they made. Maybe more than that, but a small amount of money to change a whole neighborhood. And Kaylin remembers that too. She talks about it. So I think show your kids what you're doing. Teach your kids about money.
Powerful. Well, you have localized these things so wonderfully for us. I'm looking at the clock, and I know that you have a reason to end this conversation very soon. So we will. You can be the home team and bat last. So anything else that you'd like to say? I'll just say up front how wonderful it is to be having this conversation. You've shared so much of value with us for the 2020s.
Well, I would say, I really hope that your listeners think about this and think about where their money is invested, whether it's their day-to-day money in their checking account or their savings account or their longer-term retirement account, their church assets, their labor union retirement accounts, if they belong to a Kiwanis club or civic club, how they're investing their money, the local why. Start asking questions and don't feel like you have to do it all at once. When people change their eating habits and decide to support farms in the community, they don't never buy another head of lettuce at the grocery store. But they start. They take a first step and then a second step and a third step. Do the same thing with your investments. I like to ask people to think about tithing with your investment money. Take 10% of your investment money that's now in a Wall Street mutual fund and figure out something different to do with it that's in the control of your community. And you can look up Community Loan Fund online or Community Development Credit Union. There's lots of community development credit unions. Typically, you have to live in a place or work in a place. So they're different. I can't give you a national name to look up other than self-help. Both the self-helps in California and North Carolina take money nationally. So I know that is true. There's also another really wonderful one that was started by the Methodist Church, a local Methodist church in Mississippi called Hope Credit Union, run by a guy named Bill Bynum since 1995. So very established, very deep, and now is working in 5 southern states. I think I just looked up recently and something like poverty in the towns where they operate averages 33% families in poverty. A third of the families in each of the towns they operate is in poverty. Mm-hmm. So these can make really big differences in people's lives. And they're focusing their investments on affordable housing and also on food systems. So there's a lot of synergies and interconnects between other gospel values that we hold. Mm. Don't be afraid to learn. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Maybe you want to say a little word, Lee, about the Sabbath Economics Collaborative through which we met. Find others to think about this stuff with, I guess, is my closing thought.
You bet. And of course, I'll talk about Jubilee Economics Ministries too.
Yeah.
It's been a great, great pleasure, Scott. You've been a great teacher for us. And of course, your teaching comes out of all your learning that you do. So thank you so much. And just every blessing to you on your path and in your activities. And let's talk again soon.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Lee and Scott. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In April, we shared some of the most thought-provoking interpretations of the pandemic, entitled Coronavirus, a Devastating Natural Disaster with a Message, Live Differently. In May, Life with COVID-19, Heading Toward a More Ecological World. In June, Pandemic Shows Food System Broken Opens Door to Better Choices. In July, As This World Ends, The Light at the End. In August, Leaving Superpower Ways for Earth-Size Living. In September, So Much to Learn from Outsiders, Immigrant Advocacy with author Elaine Van Ham. Do listen. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. You can subscribe to this podcast under the name Simple Living Works at your favorite podcast service. Individual episodes are available at Jubilee's new website, One Earth Jubilee, that's one word, oneearthjubilee.com, and also simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Urge your friends to do the same. Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Leigh Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.